The following presentation was recorded at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
It's in the middle here, can you?
That's good. Now you all go to sleep. All right. Well, it's been a blessing to be with all of you this weekend. You know, God has all of us in a very, very key position. And none of us are indispensable. But if you took this room out of all of our communities, it would drastically change our communities. And God has given us a very sobering responsibility. And so I love Christian education. I mentioned last night, I'm not so much about math and English and science and social studies as much as I am about people. I love young people, and I love the Anabaptist Christian faith. And for me, education is the way that I get access to young people and try to do my part to help pass on our faith. And so, you know, I'm not coming to you as a guru. I'm coming to you as the guy with the van. One of you, and just sharing a few thoughts from my perspective. Just a few things. First of all, start out with a quote by G.K. Chesterton that a lot of people like to say at conferences like these: education is simply the soul of a society as it passes from one generation to another. You know, so again, our schools are a place where we're passing our soul to the next generation. So it's just a tremendously sobering responsibility. If we don't get it right, the next generation doesn't get it right. And so there's just such a sobering aspect to that. First of all, just introduce you a little bit to my family. I'm going to spend a little bit of time in introduction here because, you know, the older I get, the more I'm interested in knowing why a person believes what they believe before I want to know what they believe. I'm interested in knowing what experiences inform them and what, because anybody can say anything. And I need to know more and more. I used to think it was crazy, you know, academics, well, this person has this and such a degree, and he does it. And you know, that matters a little bit more to me. The older I get, what are your experiences that make you believe that? So before I make any observations, I'm going to introduce you to some of the experiences that have shaped me as a person. And specifically, a lot of schools that have shaped me. I've tried out about all the different roles in education, a student, teacher, administrator, board member, parent. And just to introduce you to the schools, I thought Chester Weaver would be here. I saw him on the roster. This is where he, I don't know if he cut his teeth, but he was the principal there for quite a few years in that classroom right there. This is where I went to school for grades 1 through 10, Reams Mennonite. That's Eastern Mennonite, Pennsylvania Mennonite Conference. So that was my first school. 10 years, yeah, I broke that window right there with my shoulder. And lots of other things. The furnace room could tell some stories about me. Again, I like to say that maybe the reason I like working with the difficult students is because maybe I had some relationship to that type of student when I was in school. Now, Clayton taught over at Mount Hope Mennonite for how many years? 2 years, so... A lot of common ground here. Mount Hope Mennonite is where I went for grades 11 and 12. And in the Eastern Conference, there was not a great relationship between my crowd of friends and authorities in general. It was us and them. And one of the things that really changed as I went to Mount Hope was I started to learn that my authorities were someone I could... First of all, they're human. And you know, they actually could be fun. You could learn things from them. You could actually be a friend with them. And that was quite a revelation. I also had an incredibly devastating revelation there. My first year, grade 11, I knew the administrator acted a little bit funny. He had a very good friendship with a young lady that was in the school there. And by the end of the year, we found out that our school administrator, who was a candidate for pastor, potentially one of our local churches, a very upstanding Mennonite man, had been living a complete and total lie. And he was my hero. I mean, this was the guy that introduced me to a whole different view of relating to leaders. And not only had he assaulted a young lady that was in the school there, he also, it came out, had been visiting prostitutes on a very regular basis for years and years and years in the local city. And just, he didn't even know how many women he had been with. And this was the upstanding Mennonite man who was my hero. And to come home, my parents went to the meeting. I was looking forward to the next school year, my senior year with him. And they come home from a school meeting, and I find out that he's fired. It's all over, and he is a total, total sham. Just a devastating experience. Again, the challenge to all of us. And I even retained a friendship with him. Just one of those watershed moments in your life. After graduating from high school at Mount Hope as the valedictorian and the salutatorian, as the only one in my class, we did have a graduation. My parents left for my graduation before I left for my graduation because I was still working on my notes. The gifts were really nice, but at any rate, I graduated, I went into electrical work for a little bit, and then I went to this obscure place. It was really hard to steal good pictures of faith builders off the internet. So anyway, I went up here and learned to know Andrew Schmucker, which most of you know. Him and I terrorized this place for a few months in 1997, and then I came back for summer term. And so it deepened my understanding of education and what we can do as teachers, and that was preparation. For going back to Mount Hope as a teacher, and I went back there for a year and taught. This is an ACE school. There was 21 whole students in the school the year I taught there. I had grades 6, 7, and 8. So I had experience with a variety of sizes of schools, but it was a wonderful year. I loved it. Natural born teacher. I mean, it was just great. And so loved everything about teaching. It's just the salary was a slight problem. I wasn't sure how I was going to feed a family on $8,000 a year. And so I said, I need to do something differently. I want to be a teacher. I think I need to get some more education. So at that point, I went from being the valedictorian of my class there to a university with 8,000 students, which was a small switch. And so in my four years there, I visited some other schools. Terrible picture of McCaskey East High School in Lancaster. In the sophomore year, they tried to scare you to death. And it's just a plan at Millersville University. They send you into an urban school and try to scare you out of being a teacher. And if you survive that experience, then they'll teach you how to be a teacher. And so this was where I really got into, whoa, I'm in over my head here. As I got into this urban school, the school security comes in and slams the door and does a search of everybody in the classroom. We were learning how to be nurturing and really relate well and kindly to students. And so I would collect comments from the teachers there and email them to my class back at the university. And one of the ones that stuck with me the most was from a special ed teacher, the one who really focuses on nurturing struggling students. And she said, McCaskey East, we produce about 500 Tyson workers a year, Tyson chicken. They can go down there and play with chicken heads. And that was their nurturing statement. So it was interesting. I was getting my eyes opened. And then for my student teaching, I went over to Garden Spot High School in Eastern Lancaster County. And that's where I got introduced to the group. They had a pilot program over there. And it was for ninth graders, incoming freshmen, who were statistically destined to drop out of school. And they took about 40 of these kids, put them in two sections, and affectionately named them the group. I was working under the chairman of the social studies department, and he says, I'll never leave you alone with these kids. I mean, they are the worst that the school has to offer you. And after a couple of weeks, he left me alone with the group. And that's where I got up to start teaching. Okay, folks, and a big guy gets up and comes up, gotta go to the bathroom.
and I know he's just trying to cause trouble, so no, wait. No, I really gotta go! But now! I'll go in the waste can right over here, watch me! If you don't. And so, you know, again. I realized I was in over my head. And I, you know, somewhere along the line, I made this realization that good teachers are not born, they are made. And I was being made. And I would love to tell another story or two about the garden spot. After I graduated, I went down to Conestoga Christian School in Morgantown. And I like to say I was the Myron Dietz of Conestoga. You know, Myron Dietz, Langster Mennonite changed a bit over the years, and he was still there, that dear river brother man, after 40-some years, wasn't it, that he was there? And so I was the only plain person at Conestoga Christian. They were just finishing purging the last vestiges of Mennonitism from the school about the time I began. And so I was the token conservative, and it was fascinating. I was telling a couple people at supper how I cried in front of my administrators the second year, but that's where I really learned the game of teaching. And by about my third year, I was starting to be successful and had a wonderful relationship with the students and the parents. Loved teaching there. Taught there for 5 years. And was starting to feel like it was time for a change. I thought maybe it's time to go into the public system. I was hoping to get into a public school out in New York where I go to church. And put out my fleece there, and the Lord didn't send me that direction. And so I got a phone call in October, I believe it was, from this guy I'd never heard of. And he says, you know, we need an administrator at our school over here. Would you consider that? And, okay, you know, I was nice to him on the phone, hung up. Well, that was funny. I mean, you know, I used to think when I was young that, you know, being an administrator would be cool, but no, I see. That's like people that like to bang their heads against concrete walls. This is not for me. So I pretty much laughed it off and forgot about it, and here along about Christmas, the guy calls me back. And, do you have time to think about that? And, so anyway, they took me to Shady Maple for breakfast, and I started talking to some other people and asking advice, and people started saying, well, you should consider it. And so that's how I ended up as an administrator. It came looking for me. One of the other, okay, so that's Ephraim, where I live. Then one of the other interesting experiences at Tidings of Peace, Clayton is the administrator at Tidings of Peace in New York. Not a great picture either, sorry. Clayton and I have a very fascinating relationship. He's my pastor. He has more seniority than me as a tour guide at Willow Valley, where we give tours. I am the board chairman now, and he is the administrator. And so we have this very entangled and interesting relationship. And so, you know, he's my boss, I'm his boss, and it could get ugly. But this is probably where I really learned a little bit more about the urban schools, and it really is right in the middle of the city, a very fascinating experience. And so through 9 years of working there with the board, I've picked up quite a few experiences along the way. And then most of you know Ruben Petersheim. I also serve on the UMM board down in Baltimore, and this is us on a cold Saturday maybe about a month ago looking at buildings down there. That building could be had for not much money, but it's full of very ugly things and bird residue, etc. So we have not sold on the building yet. We need $97,000 yet before we can purchase a building. So if any of you want to write a check, we welcome you. That's an introduction to some of my experiences. So you just understand a little bit what framework I come from. Because, you know, one of the things I realized, you know, we're supposed to respect our parents. I looked at my dad, and I realized somewhere along the line, my dad is not that terribly smart. He's not dumb. It's just he's not that terribly smart. It's just my dad is older than I am, and he has a lot of experiences. And I had better respect him and listen to him, because he has the wisdom of many years of experience. And so, you know, I have a few experiences, and I hope to share with you a few of the things from my perspective. As we look at the topic, the essential role of Anabaptist schools, looking at, Patrick sent me a couple of questions related to this, and I basically just went off of them. What is our mission? How do we sell our mission? How do we convey our mission? how are we doing in our mission? And so I just want to explore those questions for a bit. The first question I popped in there, though, is how would our communities be different if all of our schools were closed? I suppose we'd either be in public school or homeschool. And I think our communities would be significantly different if that had happened. I'm not going to spend a lot of time answering that question, but our Anabaptist faith would be significantly changed if our children were being educated in a completely different way. The other side of that coin is, if our Anabaptist schools were perfect, how would our communities be different? After this conference, of course, they all will be, right? How would our communities be different if we did an even better job? So just asking those questions to jog our thinking. You know, as I think about how could we do a better job, you know, I think we need to somehow continue to draw our communities together and draw our parents into our schools. If we were doing a better job, I think we would be more of a unified unit. I think our students would come out of our schools with a truly Anabaptist worldview. We just had a speaker in at our school with Mennonite History Day. And he challenged me to think a little bit differently even about history. From an Anabaptist perspective, you know, we tend so often to have the perspective of the evangelical community around us, which is not particularly non-resistant, usually. And we tend to easily get the attitudes that they have toward war, toward immigrants. And I just found it absolutely fascinating, this speaker brought up. He said, you know, Ben Franklin, the hero of our early time here in America, he said, Ben really didn't like Mennonites. And he pulled out a quote from Ben Franklin talking about us German immigrants, our ancestors. He warned about people like us overrunning America. He said, now, those who come hither are generally of the most stupid sort of their own nation. Congratulations. And as few of the English understand the German language and so cannot address them either from the press or the pulpit, it is almost impossible to remove any prejudices they once entertained. Not being used to liberty, they know not how to make a modest use of it. I remember when they modestly declined intermeddling in our elections, but now they come in droves. Why should Pennsylvania, founded by the English, become a colony of aliens who will shortly be so numerous as to Germanize us instead of us Anglifying them? And will never adopt our language or customs any more than they, with a swarthy complexion, can acquire our English complexion. And fascinating to hear Benny say that about us. You know, because you can take Benny's words and say basically exactly what evangelicals say today about Mexicans. And it's like, wow, that jarred me. I think that's truly an Anabaptist perspective that so many times we miss. And if our schools are doing their jobs, we're changing how people think about these different topics. So what should the mission be of our school? You know, we talked about mission statement some last night. And, you know, this doesn't have to be rocket science. I know one of you said that you spent 2 years, Titus said you spent the last 2 years working on your mission statement. And, you know, you labor over the statement. You try and say, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. And you know, I know so many of us, once we get done with that statement, we say thank you, and we put it on the shelf. But you know, I want to go beyond just a statement. What should we actually be doing with our schools? And I just made a list of some of the things that I think we should be doing with our schools. And just to again jog our thinking as to what our role is in our communities. Obviously, the role of a school is to teach students. But let's look at just some of the different aspects. First of all, you always have to deal with the negative reasons for why our schools exist. And, you know, our schools were founded in many ways to avoid a lot of the things going on in the public system. And so, you know, in our area, schools are starting to go to proms. And, you know, we weren't ready to send our children to go dance in the prom. There was, you know, very strong patriotism. A lot of our people said, no, we aren't going to go pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States. And we don't want our students to be inundated with all that patriotism. And so a lot of our schools are saying, you know, just teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, and don't teach that stuff, don't allow the dance, and, you know, we're good. But over time, we are looking for positive reasons, but I think it's a mistake for us ever to forget the negative reasons that we started. You know, I had the privilege, I'll probably reference it later, but I caucus with the Mennonite Schools Council, which is the administrators of the mainline Mennonite schools from all over the United States and Canada. And so I sit with these administrators. We actually met here at Laurelville, I believe, last October, a year and a half ago. So about 35 of us administrators sat here and talked about our schools. And one of the meetings I had with MSC, we were at Lancaster Mennonite, And I just continually want to study these schools to say, what did they do right, but more specifically, what did they do wrong? Because I don't think they're where we want to be. And I was fascinated to hear these leaders of Lancaster Mennonite Schools say, yeah, tonight's the dance. The you know, the young people are going out for their you know, junior senior banquet, whatever it is, and then they're coming back and they're going to be in the cafeteria, Lancaster Mennonite School, right out front there. Everything's getting all decorated, and yeah, it's going to be the big dance till 2 a.m. tomorrow morning. And I was just stunned. You know, that started what, 1940s? We're 2010. So it took, what, 65 years? To go full circle from where they started to avoid certain things to being right back doing the exact things they left the public system to avoid. And that just absolutely fascinates me. And that's really the heart of what I want to share is I don't want to go down that road. How do we avoid that? So we look at positive reasons also. I just threw up my mission statement from EFRTA. You know, it's a nice statement. I think it embodies what we want to do. But very few people in my organization have this memorized. And we have to somehow take the ideals that are put here and put them with our faculty and also teach them to our parents and patrons as well. So what are some of the things that we need to teach? We need to teach problem solving. We need to teach applied ethics. You know, so many of our students have learned situational ethics. You know, it's okay to lie. It's fascinating when I was at Conestoga, listening to you know, them argue about whether or not it's okay to lie. And you know, and actually my co-teacher basically coming down and saying it's okay to lie under certain circumstances. We certainly need to teach academic competence and excellence. Our churches suffer because we don't teach oral communication skills as well as we could or should. Powerful writing skills. One of the things, as I've been forced to interact more with the mainstream Mennonites, is, man, they have a lot of good writers. And while I disagree with some of their theology, I started running into writing that actually talks about an Anabaptist viewpoint, and it's good stuff. And so, as conservatives, if we're to survive, I think we need to instill that in our young people. A countercultural posture. So many of our students are just consumed with blending in. And to really teach students to, you know, we aren't here to blend in. We're here to make a difference. And to get over that bashfulness and shyness of being different. You know, just can't, so much of life revolves around fitting into God's authority structure. And if our students don't learn that as children, they're destined to a life of trouble. And so if our schools are not reinforcing
a strong adherence to God's authority structure for doing our students a grave disservice. Community living skills. I love to compare the different things. When I go to the MSC conferences, we eat very well. We still stay in the Hilton in Pittsburgh. All expenses paid and flying and doing all those things. But we don't have our wives along. And it's a very different environment. And I just treasured this gathering right here, where my wife is able to be a part of it. And to hear the speakers and get support from other ladies who may or may not be, administrator widows and other things. So I just value that. It's something unique about our group. Because in other groups, we don't do this. So community living skills, how to deal with being hurt, submission, true servant leadership, etc. Our schools, one of the most critical things, I'm a person who learns by example, and I say this over and over again, I need to watch somebody in order to know how to do it. And that's what Faith Builders has been to me, a chance to observe strong teachers up there. And I love to go to Faith Builders, and I say, I don't care if they're talking about how a refrigerator works. I would like to go listen to Steve talk about refrigerators. I don't care, because he's a man who's an example to me, and Melvin and the others there. And I'm not saying that to give him a big head, but I need an example, a real-life person to follow in developing as a leader. And many of our students are the same way. They're looking for examples. And so we need to be providing those examples in our schools. Our staff is so key. Anabaptist worldview. And again, back to that, not being ashamed of who we are as Anabaptists, but instead appreciating it. Saying, wow, this is valuable. So as we think about what our mission is, you write your mission statement, you begin talking with your faculty about why you exist, and that should be a continuing conversation you're having with your faculty, why we exist. You know, how do we get people involved in this? We need to constantly be talking about what we're doing. I just had trying to start a high school at our school right now, and we had a dinner with invited in parents, people interested in the high school, and just getting up there and unapologetically saying, we are an Anabaptist school, and this is what we believe, and giving specifics of who we are and why we exist. So many people tiptoe around that. And we just have to constantly be saying, this is why we're here. This is why we're here. In Lancaster County, I've got gazillions of Christian schools surrounding me. And we have to make a case for an Anabaptist Christian school. And so we have to talk about it. So many of our Anabaptist schools, we're just simply saying, we're a Christian school, and we follow the Bible. No, we have to go beyond that. And really make a case for our Anabaptist distinctives, and constantly be relaying that to our patrons, to our community, newsletters, and different ways. We must be getting our parents educated and included as much as possible. Pastors, when I came to our school, we didn't even have an all-school chapel. So we started that on Wednesday mornings. I know many of your schools do that. Bring in a pastor from the community. And I'd love to go in there. Okay, this is a pastor from such and such a church. And how many of you see him on Sunday morning? And you see the hands go up. I hear from the pastors, wow, that just warms their heart. Wow, these are all my people. And wow, they're starting to tie in. And the feedback I'm getting is very positive. But we need to include them. In many of the larger schools, grandparents are very carefully cultivated as donors. We have Grandparents Day, but we are entering you in the database, and you'll be receiving this fundraising letter and this fundraising letter. And we do stick the bucket out at our Grandparents Day because a lot of them do want to give a gift. But I really try to downplay that. I just value it. It's just an integral part of our Anabaptist culture as well. A multi-generational
a community in raising children. And so we just love it when we get those grandparents in there and they walk around the school with their walkers or whatever. And, you know, and they sit down in the classes and invite them to read a story. Starla's dad's in there, you know, reading a story to the class or whatever. And, you know, have some grandpa drag in whatever he builds. And, you know, sit down with the class and tell them about it. And it's as we bring those people in that we're building a community that will rally around who we are and why we exist. Talk about your people. You know, again, I'm very much of a person who loves ideas, but needs to see the practical example. And as we tell stories of people, that is how we often connect. Mr. Darrell Weaver is my upper level phys ed, Bible, and music teacher, and he has transformed my school. When I first came to Effort of Mennonite, I visited, and I watched a Wednesday morning upper level worship time, and I just grieved because the teachers and administration, they were singing over here, and the students were over here, zonked out in another world, and like, there's this giant wall between them. And it's like, that will change. So I came in the first year, and I did my best to change it, to coach the teacher who was in that position. But she was having trouble with basic control. And so I went to those Wednesday morning chapels, and I did my little coaching, and I jumped up and gave my lectures. And after a couple of months, I couldn't, by proxy, change that culture. And I quit going to that chapel. It grieved me so bad, I could not go. Wednesday mornings. But at the end of the year, I was able to hire Darren, and he came in and he has transformed it. At my school, basically from sixth grade up, a boy wouldn't sing before Darren. And they actually bragged, you know, they can't make us sing at the program. You know, nobody, no amount of threats. When we get up front, we will not sing. You know, and this year our program, Darrell stood up there with four high school men and had this most awesome quintet. And my board is just thrilled. And, you know, it's people like Darrell that have just transformed my school. One of the things that just absolutely thrills me about what Darrell has done, you know, a lot of our schools try and teach witnessing. And yeah, you go out on the streets and you hand out tracts and you hand out CDs and those things, and that's good. But Darrell sort of ran into an opportunity to go to the Christian Farmers Outreach booth at the Pennsylvania Sportsman Show. Tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of people go to the Pennsylvania Sportsman Show. And the Christian Farmers Outreach, they run a booth there, and they hand out the yardsticks with the little beads explaining the path of salvation. And so Darrell went up there to that, took his high school students, and I mean, these guys are scared to death. And these are not necessarily the students I would choose to go out and represent my school as great evangelists. And it's, you know, sort of an interesting crew, you know, and they got there and, you know, the big ninth grade boy who's tough and, you know, nobody can scare him. Yeah, I'll go first. And, you know, they sat down and the person from Christian Farmers explained what they're supposed to do. And he looks over at Mr. Weaver, I can't do this. And, you know, so they put a couple people back in the booth, back praying. They put a couple students out in the aisle saying, come on in, come on in. And a couple of students are sitting down saying, hey, thanks for coming. I want to give you a yardstick here, but there's, you know, this little string of beads. I just want to explain what it means. And go through and ask them if they'd like to accept Christ as their Savior. And, you know, Darrell prayed before they went the first year. He said, Lord, you know, we ask that we would have enough persecution to understand what that is, and also that we could experience success. And they went there, and sure enough, the big guy, he got cussed out in the aisle when he tried to invite somebody in. But they had 15 people that prayed and asked Christ to become their Savior that day. And, you know, that's such a different experience than what I personally had of, you know, sticking tracks in people's face. But here they actually got to go the next step and just so transformative. And that was a watershed moment in transforming my high school. Just so appreciative of what Daryl does. It's people like him that change lives. I just have to tell one more story. There's some students in my high school that are not Christians. And this year when Christian Farmers came in, they were training in a new guy as they were preparing him to go. And this guy went around and said, I'm going to go around the room and ask if you're a Christian. And so they went around, and two people said they're not a Christian. Well, do you want to become a Christian? And he forced them to say, you know, yes or no. And then he went on, and he chatted a little more. He said, now, you understand, if I don't really give you an invitation to become a Christian, I leave today. You know, the blood is on my hands. So, and he went around to these two girls. I mean, you know, Daryl's back there. But, you know, and you know, would you accept Christ in your life? And this person, you know, and the other students are gathering around. They're saying, do it. You know, and these are the silly kids. They're crazy. They do stupid things. They, you know, they're out on four-wheelers on weekends, whatever. But all of a sudden, real life is staring them in the face. And this gal was forced to say, no, I'm not going to become a Christian. I mean, that was her choice. And the whole class is just stunned. Wow. You know, here's a 16-year-old person saying, no, I will not. And I'm not saying it because I'm proud of that student, but I am very happy with that experience, that those students were sobered. Wow, we're not all Christians. And those students know where they're at. And, you know, they have to make a choice. They know where they're going right now because they have very clearly said, no, I'm not willing to become a Christian. And so Dara continues to work on them. He just fed me some papers on Friday. He calls Jesus our garbage man, and that sent me for a loop. It's Daryl. Why are you calling Jesus a garbage man? But he said, you know, we all have garbage in our life. Christ wants to come into our life and cleanse us of that. So he asked the students to write an essay on your relationship with your garbage man. And the responses, the way he's able to connect, he's one in many. And you know, this one girl who's not a Christian, it says, I'm not saved, and here's why. And she goes on to list several bad things that have happened in her family. And I was able to coach Daryl a little bit, and, you know, we're next conversation with her. But, you know, that's the work of our school, is to lead our students to salvation, or at least to the point of, you know, knowing where they're at. And so I'm just thrilled with the work that Daryl does. Another teacher I have is Miss Arlene Burt. She's my first grade teacher. Anybody know Arlene Burt from Indiana? Yeah? Wonderful lady. She's been teaching our school for about 24 years, single lady. She tells parents every year when they come into her little programs, I don't feel like I have a job. I do what I love. And I have a student in her class this year. And her stock has gone up like... the kindergarten teacher, I thought she was kind of dispensable before last year when I had a student in there. It's like, I mean, how good can you get at being a kindergarten teacher? I mean, you teach them to color and add. But wow, after I sent a student through kindergarten, I respect kindergarten teachers. And now it's in first grade. And I respect Miss Burt even more because she loves the students. And she's coming alongside Starla and I as parents and helping us to raise our daughter in the way that we want her to go. And Arlene sends me these emails. And a few months ago, we had an occasion. We were over at our 80-some-year-old neighbors, and I watched something on television there. I don't have a television, and I don't want one, but we were over there one night, and it's something I was interested in. And so we saw television for a while, and I came home, and I sat my little daughter. My oldest is 7, the next one's 5. I mean, they don't understand lectures about this kind of stuff, do they? But I felt obligated to sit them down and say, you know, we don't have a TV, and here's why. And, you know, we don't watch a lot of movies and this stuff, and here's why. And time and garbage and everything else, and it's like, I had to go right over Sierra's head. But a little while later, I got this email from Miss Burt, you know, just out of the blue. First grade teacher sends me this email. And this is how you make the principal cry. You know? When your teacher is there rooting for you is, and encouraging you and saying, boy, you know, that little lecture I gave late one Sunday night to my 7-year-old daughter got through. It's just such a blessing. And, you know, I just got an email from her, maybe Thursday. And she was shooting me some emails, and this was the one she sent. Just bragging on her students. Just saying, boy, they're doing this. And these are first grade kids. And she's saying, you know, this one read the word machine, and this one read gravity. And it's just the joy that Arlene brings. It's just such a tremendous asset to our school. She's the person who helps deliver Effort of Mennonites' mission. And these are the people that our schools need to be filled with. These are the people that we need to be. Are our schools unique from evangelical schools? Again, you know, I love Anabaptist Christianity, and it is not enough to say we're Christian. There's so many Christians around us. When I worked at Conestoga, my supervisor was a Christian lady, and I believe she was a Christian. And it was fascinating. On our Bible quiz team, we were kind of marked among all the other Mennonites because I was quizzing coordinator, but one of my coaches was my boss's husband, and he coached a whole bunch of blonde girls. But his ponytail was about as long as all the other blonde girls, you know? And this was, yeah, you're laughing. You snow can, right? Yeah, and so I was forced to interact with other Christians who you know, believe differently than I do. But I was able to watch very closely the life of those girls and the struggles they face. And it just makes me love our Anabaptist community and culture so much more. Because so many of those kids start out with 2.5 strikes against them in their Christian life. And so we have to be more than just a Christian school. We have to be an Anabaptist school through and through. If our schools are not unique from even the other Christian schools around us, I think we'll lose both our school and our children. Now it seems like we're being exclusive, but we must articulate what we believe. Now, it's very distinctly Anabaptist that every aspect of our life is informed by our faith. And to just drill that home with godly teachers on a daily basis, it's what we're about. One of the things that's really, really troubling me right now is how we deal with technology. You know, I was raised in the Eastern Church. We didn't have a television in our home. I am eternally grateful to my parents for making that stand. But we're facing, you know, technology today. And all of a sudden, the TV and the phone and the way we do business and the way young people talk is all coming together. And I'm just troubled by this. I don't have the answer. But I think our Anabaptist schools need to come up with a few more answers in how to deal with what's going on. And, you know, our school, we at this point, we don't allow students on the internet as a general policy. We're up for accreditation, and we have to demonstrate that students use current technology in research. And I think we have to teach our students how to use the internet, because they're going to be on it. They're on it at home. They're going to be on it in business. And so we're trying to figure out how to bring it in a way that won't cause a great uproar. And so we're just struggling with this. How can I make it bulletproof? We just got a new filter, and I found out how futile and difficult it is to get a perfect filter on the internet. It is incredibly, incredibly difficult. We just paid like $1,000 to, you know, have one of our patrons who works at a computer firm put this thing in, and he kind of did a little test. And so then I was left, you know, because my reputation on the line is on the line if anybody goes anywhere inappropriate on the internet. So I decided, okay, I'm going to test this. And the default filter we had was as worthless. You could get anything inappropriate that you could dream of through that filter. And fortunately, our filter, I found out, was customizable. And so I spent hours trying every aspect of that filter out. And I am fairly happy with it now after hours of trying to defeat it. But, you know, that's one. Okay. That's where bomb making, as well as quite a few other things, I was researching. But, you know, how do we handle the internet? You know, I'm still trying to figure out a plan for next year if we're going to get our children to do searches. You know, social networking, Facebook, you guys are dealing with it at your school right now, Mike. And a lot of teachers, they're saying, can we friend our kids on Facebook? Should we? Shouldn't we? What can we say? Do we friend them, but so we can spy on them, but not post? Who was it that was just telling me that at one of our Anabaptist schools, the teacher goes on to kind of be like the chaperone. She doesn't post. Well, she does post. You know, the kid will say, the friends are typing away, and oh, I didn't get that done. Okay, I'll do it tomorrow in science class. And the teacher comes on and says, oh, no, you won't do it in science class. You know, and all of a sudden there's, you know, some accountability in that medium. But that's where our children are. You know, many of them are living in a lot of our schools. My student council has been wonderful this year, made some fabulous decisions, but one of their decisions was unpopular. And my student council went home and got beat up on Facebook that night. How are we dealing with this? So I'm just troubled with this, and I don't have the answers yet. But I think we need to be formulating some answers. The value of Anabaptist culture. I just keep coming back to stating there are many aspects of who we are as Anabaptists that is cultural. It's not heaven or hell. But our Anabaptist culture is the cradle from which our Christian faith can rise. It's a greenhouse. And everybody has to have a culture. I do not like the dominant American culture as a greenhouse for Christianity. I do not think it's a good one. And so I love our Anabaptist culture. And it just kills me to see our students throwing it away and walking away. And so if we can just constantly, as people who connect with students and love students and who live well in front of our students, tell them what a tremendous blessing our Anabaptist culture is. I think we're fulfilling a major part of our mission as Anabaptist schools. You know, it was fascinating. I was at the Mennonite Schools Council Teachers Conference in Pittsburgh, maybe year and a half ago, and they had a person who came in, very popular, and teaching all Mennonite educators, hundreds of them from all over the country, and he said, your Mennonite culture is a kind of Isaac that you must sacrifice in order to be effective at bringing your gift to the world. I disagree, Mr. Boyd. But that was his message to hundreds of Mennonite educators. Our culture, I think, can be a positive. I'm wrestling with this so much right now. I'm on the board of UMM, and I challenged Ruben at our last board meeting. And what role our culture is to play in our mission work? Because so many of our missionaries, they lose the culture as missionaries in an attempt to reach people. And in a generation or two, they lose their faith, as we know. And so I just wrestle and wrestle with this. There are some Anabaptists among us that are able to go out and say, this is who we are. I am a Christian, and I live in this Anabaptist culture. You're welcome to come and join me. You're welcome to come and join me. And they have enough of a positive draw that Anabaptism isn't something that drives them away. It's a badge of honor. And that is what I think our schools need to do. My passion is that our Mennonite schools do not become statistics. There's a very distinct pattern that has played out in the schools in my area in the last number of years. Many, many, many schools have started in response to all the negative reasons, started out as conservative Anabaptist schools, have served effectively for years, and then have changed drastically. And many of them have followed a very, very predictable pattern. And so just running through the pattern, most of the Mennonite schools in our area of the more mainstream line started out conservative, doctrinally sound. Over time, as the church has drifted, they have drifted over the course of 30 years. As they've drifted, as they've changed, as people have lost the sense of mission, they start losing students, and they start losing finances. The two do go together. And so as the school falls into crisis, they're in big money trouble, and they're in big constituency trouble, they start going through administrators like toilet paper. And not all of them. Sometimes they can do it in only one or two administrators, but some of them will go through five or six. And then they get an administrator who saves the day. And that administrator comes in and says, we're no longer a Mennonite school, we are now a Christian school. And he opens the door wide and says, we now have a much broader focus. And they welcome in people. And I'm not saying everything about this is bad, but then they welcome in the broader Christian community. And that brings in a whole new constituency. And typically the people that can afford that are fairly well-to-do, small business owners. And so we have new students coming in, we have new money coming in, and the school, the administrator, first of all, is a hero. Financial stability and growth. And as that pattern continues, typically we become a higher and higher level school, and we work for excellence, academic excellence, 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 excellence. And a lot of our faith things become weaker and weaker. And in many ways, at Conestoga, you know, it's a very nice school. They have a beautiful facility. But as I said, about the time I got there, they were purging just the last things that had to do with Mennonite out of it. And, you know, and I was just visited a school for a day. Me and a administrator from Pennview Christian School went to a school in Lebanon. And, you know, the administrator, he was the hero who had just changed it. He said, yeah, we went from 80% Mennonite, 20% other, to 20% Mennonite, 80% other. The school is just growing. He's the hero. But it's not teaching what I love and what I believe. We're called to teach our children. And then they lament and say, nobody wants to teach in our school. It's Mennonite. There's no really strong sense of mission. And Mennonite students, of course, are looking elsewhere. And things change. And I've listed, and you can challenge me if you want to, but I've listed most of the major Mennonite schools in my area that have done this. And I know most of the administrators from almost every one of these schools personally. I respect them, but they have gone through this change. And some are at different places on it. Some are earlier in the change, some are later. And my heart is that we don't join that list. Just to provide evidence to what I just said, at the last Mennonite Schools Council administrators meeting in Ohio, they brainstormed a list of concerns to talk about at the next administrators meeting in Ontario in a few weeks. And these are the things they talk about. Some of them are common to us. Concerns about enrollment, number of students declining, percentage of Mennonite students in our schools, our teacher candidates aren't willing to move to come to us. What's the trend? We're generally strained, declining, fewer Mennonites, no money. Down through, declining enrollment, we need to downsize our budget. Candidates for teachers are rarely Mennonite. Almost all of the major MSC schools have less than 50% Mennonite constituencies. And so that's a drastic change. I don't want us to join that list. Four minutes. How are we doing? The book Already Gone is back there on the table. Fascinating book. If you get a chance to, it just gives some very up-to-date statistics on what's going on in evangelical Christianity. The basic statistic is that they say, look around, the conservative, not Christian in general, the conservative Christian community in America, conservative Christians
Go look at the youth in their church on a given Sunday morning. Go down the line and count. 1, 2, 3. 2 out of every 3 will be gone within about 15 years. It's the statistics. I don't have time to go into how they did it. Very fascinating study. Very good pollster. And 2 out of every 3 will be gone within about 15 years. That's the statistic for evangelical Christianity. You know, and I did a study at our church, and it'd be fascinating for you to sit down and do studies of your churches. In my church, I found that, about 75% of our stayed Christian, and about half of that 75% followed in their parents' footsteps, as in a similar church. Nationally, the Christian schools out there, they're just losing. They're losing the battle. And again, that book I just referenced, Already Gone, it gives a prescription for something that we need to be doing to work with our students. Specifically, are we answering their questions well? If we do not answer our students' questions well, basic questions, when they're 12 and 13, that's when they've concluded we're losing them. If we don't answer their questions, their honest questions about our faith well, we will lose them. Be ready to give a reason. What's the plan? How do we keep our Anabaptist schools? Like I just said, answering their questions. Another one is connecting with students. And this is something, I just love students. And love the difficult ones. It's nice when there's some that are good too. I think to the degree that we as leaders of schools and our staff can connect with students, not just teach math at them, not just teach English at them, but love them and connect them and convey who we are as Anabaptist Christians and our passion for that, it's how we're going to change our communities for the future. Moving our students toward real-world achievements. I don't have time to give examples. Making history, the study of the stories of real people, helping things come alive. Just like giving an example of my teachers. All of a sudden, things come to life. We had a local Mennonite come in and talk about John and Anna Bear. In our area, he told about the Effort of Cloisters, real close to our school, where they printed the Marcher's Mirror. And he came in and told the story of John and Anna Bear, a local Mennonite couple, 1700s, who had to choose whether to help the enemies, the Patriot Army, or who was trying to kill their son, or to stay home. And this couple, this Mennonite pastor couple, they went to the Effort of Cloister to help the wounded Patriot soldiers who would kill their son if they found him in an instant. And ultimately, they both got sick and died as a result of that. And so just connecting our students with the stories of our Mennonite history, just absolutely fascinating and riveting for them to hear, but then connecting them. What do we have to offer our churches, communities, and nation? Personally to me, I've just been reveling in the idea of me as an Anabaptist Christian being an ambassador for Christ. There's so many questions. We say, what do I do about this? What kind of house should I live in? What kind of car should I live in? And I've started running things through the ambassador filter. And that doesn't answer all the questions, whether it's a VW or a Chevy. But so many questions are answered when I look at myself as an ambassador for the kingdom of Jesus Christ. I was at a family gathering with Mennonite relatives, and my wife's aunt said, "Do you vote, Glendon?" She thought I sounded conservative enough, and she, "Well, you should." And so I didn't get an argument with my wife's aunt at the family gathering. And I really had a good argument after I left. And I thought I could have put her in her place, but I was glad I didn't. Family unity. But that really made me think. She believes in a dual citizenship model. She's a kingdom, part of the kingdom of heaven and a citizen of the United States. And so there's this conflict between those two kingdoms, and I should need to vote. Well, if you need to vote, you need to support the military too, sweet theory. And so there's this conflict when it's a dual citizenship. But as I think of myself as a sole citizen of of the kingdom of heaven, so many things become clear. And that's what we offer to our churches, our communities, and nations, an ambassadorship in the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And I think that is a very, very exciting invitation to offer to the people around us. 1 Corinthians 5. Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. And all things are of God, who hath reconciled us to himself by Jesus Christ, and hath given us the ministry of reconciliation, to wit, that God was in Christ, reconciling the world unto himself, not imputing their trespasses unto them, and hath committed unto us the word of reconciliation. Now then, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God did beseech you by us. We pray in Christ's stead, be reconciled to God. That's the job of our schools. And I wish all of you good success in that mission.
Thank you, Glenda. Maybe you have a question or a comment that's been stirred by something you said here. Just give you a few moments here to ask that or respond or say whatever you want to say here.
Glenda mentioned our interesting tangled relationship. It thrills my heart as a pastor to hear Glennon defending the Anabaptist faith in that way. And I rejoice in that. And I trust that all of us can, without any embarrassment, defend our ambassadorship that way. And before you dismiss everybody, I'd like Glennon to get back to that picture of the school. That's something I want to show the whole group. But that's different than what you're asking for right now.
Okay. Who else? What else? Thank you. Jeremy?
What?
There's something rolling around your head.
I just wondered.
Okay. He wanted to say something.
I guess there is another thing I was thinking about, though. I feel a drive to articulate what we believe, what our mission is, etc. There's an interesting thing that I notice about these liberal Mennonite schools and churches that he was referring to. I really like their mission statements, and even some of the mission statements of the churches, to make Christ the center of everything. And they really have it laid out well on paper. And then, like you said, you look at some of the youth who have had two strikes against them somehow, and you wonder, you know, where they missed it. And so then I wonder to myself, so how does it go forward? How much of going forward is in articulating it? And does anything get lost, even maybe possibly just in the process of articulating it? I really appreciate what Pete said about the importance of people just being there. For example, I think the students are hungry. That's a word that popped in my head. They're hungry, for example, of people that actually live it out.
Examples, heroes. You know, I don't even mind a student putting a picture of Shaquille O'Neal on the locker because it gives me a great opportunity to talk about heroes. No, it's coming off. But our students are saturated with heroes that it's not okay. That's all there's to it. And you make a very good point.
I'm left with a hunger for more resources that would portray what he just did. He stood up there and was able to unapologetically present the Anabaptist point of view in a way that has extreme value and purpose, meaning, and gave us a couple of examples. And I thought, man, he just had a website that I could go to.
Bob Linden? Okay, who else? What else?
Two thoughts. Well, I didn't write down everything, and I would really appreciate a copy of the PowerPoint if I could.
Is that possible, Linda?
Sure. Unless it's copyrighted. Secondly, and this isn't the big vision picture thing, but I appreciated the concern you raised about internet in our schools and how to deal with that. And I would love to be able to discuss that sometime, whenever. just because that's something we grapple with, and the whole social networking, and how do we guide our students in this? I try to keep up, but I'm still falling behind.
That's good. That is. Let's keep that in mind. We'll back burner the discussion, okay, until a little later. Whenever, but I think it'd be worth people that have some interest there in having a good discussion about that.
Can I give you an opportunity to put a commercial plug in for a workshop that you had at Faith Builders with Petrovsky? That's a good resource.
Yeah, it's good. Jim Petrovsky is a man who has a fair amount of experience and done a lot of research into some of this. Is that paper available or is it just recording? How is that?
I'm not sure.
We have to do a little research there, maybe.
I think it's online.
Is it online?
I think, if not at our site, on his site.
Okay. Maybe we do a little research there as well and get back to people. We can go.
Do a little hunting.
Get some wireless and do a little hunting. Yeah. We give you guys a website. That's excellent. There are some good resources.
I really appreciated the things he had to say that we can...
Okay, well, it's obviously stirred something in us. The number of calls and questions that get pushed my way tell me that we're in some form of trouble in a lot of our schools. There's some question about the viability, long-term viability of our schools. I think it is connected to what's presented here tonight. So I encourage us to think about that. All right, we'll do a little transition here. And we said that we'd spend a little time picking your brains about where we could go with some things. What we'd like to do here, we've had some interest in having the ladies get back together again. And we'd like to have part two of Cynthia's session this morning. Just a discussion time. There were some questions that came up in your discussion groups. Were never really put to rest at all. Not that you can put everything to rest, but it's like there was stuff there. It seemed like there was a fair amount of energy to discuss it, only just not the time to discuss it. We'd like to have an opportunity for that coming up here. So actually, ladies, in just a moment, I'm going to let you go right above us here in that room. And there'll be a room prepared sort of in a bigger circle. And Cynthia will simply moderate that. And just follow up on her presentation this morning, okay? Now, I don't know if it's mandatory for you ladies, but there's the opportunity, okay? You guys, it's mandatory. We need you right here, okay? And so what I'd like to do, I don't know if there's a way we can do a 3-minute break and be back here or not.
Ring a bell.
I had a few guys tell me, there's no bell. How do we know what time it is? True administrators. School bell. I'd like just to be able to stretch, grab some coffee if you need it, a few things like that.
A picture,
okay, thank you. You go ahead and get there in the meantime, back at the ranch.
I'll tell you ahead of time until he finds it.
Right, which one do you want?
The school, Times B School. And right beside there, okay. You see the right of the school, there's a house with a white roof.
Yeah.
And then beside that is a black roof. Okay, that's a duplex. We bought the house right beside the school for $10,000, and our male teachers are living there. The house, the other half of the duplex is currently for sale for $30,000. We offered them $10,000, and now they have to decide whether they're going to give it to us or not. My vision is that those houses would disappear and a gym would go there. And so I'm just asking you all to pray for us, pray that they would accept that offer. They have my letter telling them all the benefits of the community, that if that house would be ours. And so I just ask that you would pray that that would be possible.
Okay. All right. Cynthia, I think we're looking at 45 minutes maybe. I don't know if it'll take us that long down here. We get done with what we're doing. You ladies can go to midnight probably. That's my hunch. And but anyway, the guys have a few discussions otherwise too, maybe that needs to be had about technology and things like that. So dismissed, I'd like to give you guys 3-4 minutes max to be back in here. We'll do some more things.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.